Dave's psychology lectures are part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
So we're right about here. We're going to finish up the stuff, the sort of history and origin stuff, and then we'll get into a bit about brain organization. I was talking about this last time, about how we split off from the chimps. And again, I shouldn't say that. It should say we and the chimps split from our common ancestor 5 million years ago. The chimps are our closest relatives. We share about 98-99% of our genes with them. There's very little that makes us us or makes us different from a chimp. We're basically apes. What happened, a few hundred thousand years ago that made us into us, it's probably a change in the ecology, and it probably had something to do with the diet. So we started, instead of going up after the fruit and stuff like that, we started probably hunting and gathering, which is, you know, the ancestral lifestyle of all the humans. That's our life history, really, is that we're hunter-gatherers. And though most of us don't act like that anymore, there was a time when all the humans were like that. So it was probably going out and looking on the plains for food. And when you do that, you have to stand up. So that's the key thing, because one of the big changes here is that your heart now has to pump blood up, not across. When you think about it, any other animal is on four legs, right? Yeah, I know that, you know, for example, chimps do sort of look like they still use they're hunched over. And someone mentioned kangaroos after class, but actually when you look at kangaroos, they still use their front legs. Bears can stand up, but they don't spend their whole life standing up. So we're really the only animal, and in fact, we're the only animal that is built to do this, right? Our pelvis is actually structured differently than any other mammal. We're built to stand up. Nothing else is built to stand up. So it shows that we are specialized for standing up, which is an important thing. And when you specialize for standing up, your heart has to work a lot harder. Now, the notion is that, and we can look at size of skulls and things like that, that the brain size wasn't so big. The standing up happened first, then the brain started to grow. Now you have a lot of sort of extra oxygen and sugar you can use. Your brain uses 25% of your sugar and 75% of your oxygen, I think are the numbers. Or it's the other way around, maybe. 25. Yeah, I think it's probably the other way around. Did I have it right the first time? It makes more sense the other way. Lots. It uses lots of your metabolic resources, okay? You know, cells run on sugar, they run on which they convert. To ATP in the mitochondria, and that's what fuels cells, right? So suddenly you've got all this extra capacity because the heart has to be powerful enough to pump blood up. So basically now you have extra fuel that you could use for a bigger brain. A bigger brain is clearly going to be smarter, right? I would imagine. Makes some sense. Like I said the other day, we don't have big teeth. We aren't good at fighting. Other animals, right? Think about, we're in Africa a few hundred thousand years ago, maybe a couple million years ago. Saber-toothed cat, they only died out like 10,000, 15,000 years ago. They were around pretty recently. And other big, scary animals. And even just the animals that are in, you know, Africa now, lions and tigers and ligers. So I really have to stop referencing Napoleon Dynamite. I really do. I can't, though. I just can't. I think maybe now I'll start referencing Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. About the same year, but I think it's a little more my speed, actually. That's good to know. Eh? The movie I really like is about two guys that get so stoned that they have to go get a hamburger. You really should see the movie. It's awesome. So we got to find some. Why are we successful? How can we compete against these guys and hunt them and kill them and eat them, right? We can't run as fast as them, right? Fast a human can run today without steroids. I don't think we have that record. I think they're all with steroids. This boy, about 9.77 seconds for 100 meters. I compare that to a cheetah, right? However, we can outsmart them. Is there sort of deception that goes on in the rest of the animal kingdom? Hell yes. And next year, it'll probably be offered to take animal behavior with me, and you'll learn all about it. It's awesome. But it's not the same kind of, it's not like changing on the fly kind of deception. It's not adapting the way humans do. We're amazing at this kind of stuff. So what I'm saying is that big brains means big smarts, and that's where humans come from. You can sort of talk about something called an encephalization quotient. You take the brain size and you divide by the body size, in essence. And arbitrarily, the cat was put at 1.0. Okay, so you just, it's just to even everything out. We're at about a 4. We're at about a 4. Rats are about a 0.8. Dogs are at 1.1. Then, of course, you got elephants. They're a lot lower because they got big brains, but they're huge. Dolphins, though, are around 6. So it's obviously not that great, because do you see any dolphins running the planet? So, I mean, it's really rough. We can compare, for example, food storing and non-storing birds, which is something that I'm quite interested in. Done a lot of research on this stuff. And birds that store food and recover it hours or days later for consumption, their hippocampus, which is part of your brain that's important for memory. It's important for memory if you're a human or a Clark's nutcracker or a black-capped chickadee or a marsh tit, right? They depend on finding their own food. They store food and find it later. You know, like you think about squirrels, all these little birds do this too. So if you take a look at their hippocampal volume and you divide it by their brain volume and adjust it for body size, these birds, these food stores, their hippocampus is way bigger than it should be. That part of their brain that's really important for remembering stuff is way bigger than you would expect due to just the size of their brain, their body and their brain. Compared to, you can even look at within, like if you look within the family of parrots, that's the marsh, chickadees and titmice, the storing birds, like chickadee, marsh tit, which is like a British version of a chickadee, they're very similar. It's hard to really tell the difference. The only way you can really tell the difference is they say chickadee, day, day. You compare them to, say, a non-storer in that family, the great tit's a non-storer, and their hippocampal volume's way off the chart compared to great tit, for example. Okay. You ever get really into something and you forget what you're typing? And one day I was trying to Google something. I was honestly, and I'm not making this up, I typed into Google great tits. Because I was looking up something about some birds and I needed some quick facts. You know, and guess what I found first? And I'm pretty computer savvy. I've been using the internet since 1986. But that one, I went, oh, that was a mistake. That's not what I meant. Then I used the Latin name Paris Major and everything was fine. Within a species, this is a question now. If I have two people and they're the same size, okay, but one guy's got a bigger brain than the other guy, is that guy smarter? There may be something to that, but it's probably horribly subtle. On the other hand, we know that men and women, for example, are equal on an IQ test. On average, women have an IQ of 100 and men have an IQ of 100. Women have smaller brains than men even when you factor out their body size. It's just true. That said, there's no difference in intelligence. Women may make up for size in efficiency. There's more connections between the left and right hemisphere in a woman than there is in a man. Okay, so trying to look at it within species is not an easy thing to do. It's not very useful. There may be something to it, and maybe someday we'll be able to do that. I imagine that one day when you walk in, when you go get an IQ test, they won't give you a pencil and paper test. They'll probably just lie you down and put you in a machine, and a number will come up, you know. But until that day, you know, there's very little. We can't talk about it really within species. Here I'm constantly talking about this between species, right? Between different stores and non-stores. Between different early hominids and us. The other thing you can look at, for example, is Neanderthal had a bigger brain than we do. And you see any of them around? No, we won. Homo sapiens. Oh, yeah. So it's not nearly as clear as, and very few different species. Neanderthal and us, they're two different species of hominid. They're gone, we're still here, they have bigger brains than we do. It's not all, we can then make the assumption that they weren't as smart as us, probably. Huh. So it's still even tenuous between species sometimes. With the food stores, non-stores, you got a huge range of many, many different species. So it's a little bit different there, right? But here we're just comparing two species. That's two data points, eh? Think about that. For those of you taking Psych 2127, would you be very confident if you had two data points to compare something? Even if you aren't taking the research methods course, I would certainly hope that if we had, you know, this person and that person treated them differently and found a difference, you wouldn't be confident that, your independent variable caused the effect. I hope not, anyway. If not, you're going to fail 2127. It's pretty clear that you need more than that for data points. So there we just had two, Neanderthal and us. Right? Any questions about this stuff? And about any of the sort of Darwin stuff and the history stuff we talked about before we move on? All right. So that's that one. No, we're not done yet. We got a whole nother one to do. All right. Am I spelling neuroanatomy incorrectly there? Because PowerPoint keeps telling me that's a spelling mistake, but it seems to me that's how you'd spell neuroanatomy. No, really, doesn't it look right?
It looks right.
Yeah, it looks right to me too. Maybe it, well, the thing is, it knows other words, like words that it shouldn't know, like diencephalon. There's some that's really strange technical terms it knows, but it doesn't know neuroanatomy. I don't know. Anyway, we're going to talk a bit about anatomy and a bit about physiology. What's the difference? Anatomy is the stuff. Physiology is how the stuff works. Okay? So anatomy is like, this is my arm. Except I think it's got a Latin name. It's the armus. But how does it work? Well, then you got all the circulatory system. You can name all those bits, right? All your various nerves and veins and what have you, and muscles. But then you can talk about how they work, how they interact. That's physiology. Okay, so anatomy and physiology are two. It's one of these things, one of these classic things that happens all the time in science. We divide things up and then say, yeah, but really, there's stuff that's in the middle. So we're going to talk mostly about anatomy. I'm not going to tell you a lot about function right now in the next day and a half. That said, it's kind of hard to talk about anatomy and not mention anything about physiology. So some physiology will come in. But I'm going to talk, for example, about neurons, but I'm not going to really talk about how they work right yet. Okay, so that's anatomy and physiology. They really, like I said, at some point, to get the whole picture, you need to know both anatomy and physiology. Brain organization. It's organized in at best, I think the book says it's a semi-random pattern, which is being very charitable. There is very little rhyme or reason to how it's organized. There's a lot of stuff about living things that seems disorganized. You would not engineer an animal. If you were to build one from the ground up, you probably wouldn't make the organization the way that we have ended up, or any other animal. There's a lot of really big inefficiencies. On the other hand, there are some things that just blow you away. Some of the names can be confusing because the names of regions of the brain are either Latin or Greek, because I think neuroscientists are pretentious. So they don't want you to know what they're talking about. This is my theory. This stuff really, honestly, it's really pretty easy. A lot of it's memory work, I know, but really it is pretty easy, because what you have here are names of stuff. For anatomy, you just have to know what stuff's called. They're actually very simple names, but they're in Greek and Latin. Right? So I don't really think neuroscientists are pretentious. I'm kidding. Well, I know some pretentious neuroscientists, but that doesn't mean all neuroscientists are. Okay, anyway. Here's one, substantia nigra. You know what that means? Black stuff. Black substance. That's what that means, because it stains black. That's all it means. They got to name it something. But that says nothing, of course, about its function. Substantia nigra is a really dopaminergic area that helps control smooth movement of muscles. Does that say anything about black stuff? You know, and they couldn't call it black stuff because, you know, they'd be like, they'd look stupid, so they'd use some Latin. Zona incerta. That's one of my faves. That's the uncertain zone. I don't know what this is. I think it's the uncertain zone. How do you say that in Latin? But that's what it's called, okay? Some of them make a little bit of sense as far as how they look. Hippocampus. If you speak French, you know that a seahorse is called a hippocamp, right? And you also, if you speak Greek or Latin, you know hippocampus, right? Seahorse. The hippocampus, which I was talking about before, is kind of shaped like a seahorse in that it's kind of curled. It's shaped like, it looks like a seahorse if you've been looking at seahorses all day and people keep yelling seahorse, seahorse, seahorse at you and you've taken a lot of acid. I mean, it looks just vaguely like a seahorse. Amygdala is a Greek word for almond, and the amygdala is shaped like an almond. That's nice, but you have to actually know Greek. Now this, of course, I talked about. This is does memory. This has a lot to do with emotion and emotional memory. So those names are sensible in a sense. It involves you knowing a little bit of some ancient language, or, well, Greek isn't ancient anymore now. It's still around, isn't it? But Latin is. But it's not so bad. But these two guys here are just like, it's like they were messing with you. You know, it's like they should have called part of it gooey bits and put that in Latin and just see what people say, you know? Okay. So it's hard to remember a lot of these names. Now, some of them are going to make some sense, some of them aren't, okay? Whatever works for you in remembering where stuff is, and I can pretty much guarantee you there will be a diagram of a brain or perhaps a neuron on your first test, and you'll have to label it. Because you have to know this stuff. So whatever helps you understand, go with that. Okay, some key terms. Anterior. It's the front. Caudal. The top. Dorsal. Dorsal is like dorsal fin. Frontal is at the front. Inferior is below. That's an easy one. Dorsal's easy because you can remember dorsal fin on like a shark. I don't know. Lateral, across. Medial, middle. I'll talk about that in a second. But medial's in the middle. Posterior, well, you know that. It's the back, right? Anterior front, posterior back. Rostral is a cut like this, across towards the beak. Rostrum is Latin for the beak. So a rostral section like that. Sagittal is the other way. All right. Superior, it's above. And ventral is towards the front, towards the gut, basically. towards the belly. Now, we use these terms. They allow us to specify either like sagittal and rostral. We can talk about different cuts when you're looking at a section of tissue. But we can also talk about, for example, where something is. The first paper I ever was an author of, which I was the third author of five, but it was a project I did in fourth year, and what's the title? I can never, see, remember the other, well, no, there are articles that I reference all the time that I can remember, but my own work, I never know any of it. Central place foraging is disrupted by lesions to the dorsal medial thalamic nucleus. I think that's what it's called. Dorsal, top, medial, middle, thalamic, thalamus, nucleus, in the thalamus. So the middle top part, you see that? It's a dorsal medial. So we can do things like that. So you might hear somebody talk about the superior colliculus. That's the top part above the colliculus, which is a part of the brain, which we'll talk about when we get to vision. Okay. So all these things allow us to do is use a shorthand. Instead of me saying, you know, sort of at the top but in the middle, I can say dorsal medial. And you go, oh, okay, dorsal medial, yeah. That's all these terms allow us to do. They're nothing, and actually, I think all those are all Latin, aren't they? Yes, those are all Latin. So that's just, you know, I'm never going to ask you what does rostral mean, but I might say this is a rostral section, and you'll have to look at, oh yeah, rostral section, sure, from here to here. Okay? So that's just so we have some common language. The outside of the brain. So first we got the brain itself, but it's held inside something. It's called the meninges. It's like a, you know, it's like a plastic bag, if you want to go with an analogy, okay? And that's, within that, there is CSF, cerebral spinal fluid. So it's cushioned. It's got to be cushioned. You got to have, like, you can't just have your brain sitting there and it easily hit your skull. That, by the way, is how you get knocked out. A lot of times, if somebody punches you in the face and you get knocked out. Now, I realize most of that doesn't happen to most of us, but you've watched the boxing, the modern-day gladiating, the boxers. You punch somebody in the face hard enough, their head snaps back and their brain hits against the back of their head and it knocks them out. Typically, though, like when I do that with my head, move it quickly, there's enough cushioning in there that I don't knock my brain doesn't get knocked around, I hope, anyway. Try to avoid doing that, though. Within that, we call the thing, you can also hear it called the cerebrum, the whole big stuff in the head. So that's sort of the brain part, if you will. And then there's the cerebellum, which is this little tiny mini brain, which is, in Latin, really, that means not little tiny cute brain, sort of, is what it means. It really does. I went to high school with a girl named Sarah Bell, and we always called her Cerebellum. We thought we were really clever. Believe me, some of these people that I went to high school with were not clever. Others were, but some were not. So, and I'll draw a really rough diagram, but if that's your brain, which seems to look vaguely like a bicycle helmet, your cerebellum's back here. It's not. That's not quite the scale. It'd be a little bit smaller than that. It looks a lot like a brain. It's small. That's about probably the right size, okay? And, though, it's round. It's a sphere. It's not just a disc. But it's got, like, the lumps and all that stuff, right? It's got the wrinkly bits. And it's clearly a different unlike, like, say, for example, when you're looking at the different lobes, and you probably learned this in intro, and we'll talk about the lobes maybe today, maybe next time, but you talk about frontal and occipital and parietal and temporal. There isn't really a place where you, it's not like you could, if you opened up your head, you can see, oh, clearly here's the dividing line between frontal and parietal. Whereas with the brain and the cerebellum, there's a clear difference. Like, you can see the cerebellum's a different thing. Now, there are many sulci and gyri. In other words, the singular is sulcus and gyrus. A gyrus is a bump, a sulcus, or a, you hear some people say sulcus. I don't think that's correct, because it's Latin. All C's have a hard K. Actually, there were no C's. They just had G's. But that's a whole other thing. Sulcus and gyrus.
The C is hard?
Yeah. No, there were no G's. There were just C's. Alpha, maybe. I don't know. I can't remember. I remember so little of high school Latin. But, so the sulci, those are like the grooves. And the gyri are these, the lumps. Okay?
What does the cerebellum do?
What does it do? It does, probably has something to do with timing of movements. It has to do with smooth movement. It has a little bit probably to do with balance, things like that. A lot of very basic things. Yep, a lot of very basic things. And we can talk about, say, you'll see a different gyrus, like dentate gyrus does this. So you'll hear sometimes that term being used. It's all black there. Okay. Okay, then you got the brain stem. It's kind of like, put that there. There. So that's like the, now it's funny because I have before, oftentimes when I have these diagrams on a test, it's label the diagram and give me a couple words about what it does. Just a couple of words, you know? So if it was occipital lobe, you just write vision, that's fine. So I've had the brainstem once is something for people to label, and they nailed it. So brainstem holds the brain up. That's not really what it does. You have cranial nerves, which are basically nerves that run out, there's 12 sets of two, and they run out and in to the brain. There's a lot of arteries and veins. Your brain, it needs so much power. You know, there's enough there's enough voltage in your brain, enough current running through your brain to run like a fridge. I don't know how you'd hook that up, but there's a lot of current in there, okay? Because there's so much power being used. About 25% of your glucose, 75% of your oxygen, as I mentioned before. So blood's pretty important. This is why you need the blood in the brain. If it's using up all this sugar and all this oxygen, you can see that, like, let's say your blood flow gets cut off to your brain. This will be a problem. Or, whoops, no, I didn't even do that, but no, well, that's good enough. You get a stroke. Now, if you take the human neuropsychology course next term, we'll spend a couple of classes on strokes, and there's a whole lot of subtypes and such, so whatever. But usually what we're talking about here is the flow of blood, and therefore oxygen, is cut off. On the other hand, you can get like a vein that like bursts. That's an aneurysm. Yeah. And what happens there? See, if you don't get enough oxygen, tissue dies. It's pretty simple. On the other hand, with an aneurysm, they can often be worse, because what happens there is that you get a whole bunch of blood that pools up, and it basically, because of the pressure, destroys part of the brain. Okay. Some gross internal features. When I say gross, I don't mean they're icky, but they probably are. You want to have your hand in there. It's a little mushy. But it's also, what it means, gross anatomy, it just means big bits. Okay, there's ventricles, and they're big, like big gaps. And what do they do? Why are they there? I don't know. We're still learning about the brain. There's white matter and gray matter. White matter is myelinated, so there are cells with myelin, which is just a covering, and we'll talk all about myelin when we talk about how nervous transmission works. What the hell is this? You find the greatest things just sitting in classrooms. I don't know what that is. And then gray matter is just unmyelinated. I want to see what's in this bag now. I'm just curious. It's gonna really? Yes, it is. My brother once jumped off like a 5 foot high like fence when he was like 4, holding an umbrella thinking it would break, like he'd be like a parachute. He broke his arm. Well, that was fun. I enjoyed that. Put it back where it was. The people listening to this that aren't in the class, they're like, what the hell was he doing? I'll tell you, I found an umbrella and I did a little routine, little dance. I'm very creative, you know, and it's a creative outlet, my dancing. You ever seen me dance, you know that it's not. If that's a creative outlet, then I ain't creative. All right, so basically, in very gross terms, you've got, you know, white matter, gray matter, etc. Let's talk about some internal organization here. Oh, look, a diagram that apparently is copyrighted by that company, and I didn't pay them. There's four lobes. See, there you go. There's cerebellum. It's not a bad diagram. Not bad. You got the frontal lobe. It's at the front. That's an easy one to remember. It's not going to be at the back. So that's an easy one. Got the parietal lobe. It's up here. Okay, because this is like looking this way. Temporal, way I remember, I used to remember that one way back when I was a student, is that it's by your temples. Temporal. And occipital, it's your occipital bone back here. It would be so much easier if they called that the bacal lobe, because that's the frontal lobe, but that's not what they went with. And you can see there's the brainstem and the cerebellum. You can see there's a lot of sort of basically like Celci and gyri here, but they're smaller. In general, they have function, specific functions, but remember, it's very general. I'll give you a rough idea here. The frontal lobe is doing a lot of sort of higher order cognition, a lot of planning, a lot of thinking, what we would call thinking in sort of popular parlance. So it's problem solving. It's probably a lot to do with things like personality, okay, stuff like that. The temporal lobe has a lot to do with language production and reception. It also has a lot to do with, it has some, does a little bit of vision as well. And again, this is in very general terms, okay? The parietal lobe up here does spatial relationships, does a little bit of vision too, but it also does spatial relationships. So your sense of left and right is up there. And you know the episode of Seinfeld where Crazy Joe Davola kicks Kramer in the head? Right, and his helmet saves him. It's actually right, either someone took a course like this, or frankly, they just said that the dent in the helmet looks good there. But that is, it's probably the case then, like that would be right about where you'd get hit to get what he had, which is, remember, he started to ignore part of the world. You get contralateral neglect. So you actually ignore the left half of the world, and you're hit on the right side of your, and it's on the parietal lobe. It's pretty freaky too, because you can ask somebody a question like, you show them a clock, you just draw. Okay? So you draw a clock for them. Let's make it 3 o'clock on here, okay? And you say, could you draw this for me, please? The typical kind of neurological test that's done. And they'll draw a clock, okay? And then they'll do this. Yeah. So they'll miss half the world. In that episode where Kramer doesn't shave half his face and only, that's in fact a very common thing that happens with guys is they when they have this injury, they only shave half of their face. And they'll only put one leg of their pants in. Well, I don't know about that. Kramer did that though. But you see, or they only wash half their body. Yeah. Weird, eh? The truth is always stranger and cooler than fiction. The occipital lobe does vision and nothing else. Notice how every other lobe also does some vision. I didn't mention, frontal lobe doesn't do a lot of it, though a lot of the input it's getting is visual. The occipital lobe basically does vision. And it does it extremely well. We're very visual animals. We have color vision, which the majority of animals don't have color vision. Probably because they don't need it. We need it. There are various different layers to the occipital lobe. We'll learn all about the occipital lobe. But there's these various different layers, and they do everything from sending information out to the other layers to detecting motion. It's pretty amazing. If you get a lesion to a certain part of your occipital lobe, so like you have a stroke and it damages part of your occipital lobe, or you get a really bad bump in the head, you may, for example, things may disappear as soon as they move because there's a separate system for detecting shape and motion. So stuff would disappear as soon as it moved. So you could never cross a street because it would never look like there were cars. There are people that have what's called blind sight, where V1, which is visual, it's also called visual cortex. I mean, it's so specialized, we sometimes call occipital visual cortex. V1 gets lesioned, which is this sort of sensory switchboard area. Well, visual switchboard, it sends information out for analysis. A lot of times then people report being blind, and in fact they are blind. You can ask them where a stimulus is, they don't know. But you can put an object in front of them and say, could you reach out for the object in front of you, please? And they say, I can't see. You say, fine, just try. And they put their hand in the right shape. Or you throw a Nerf ball at them. You don't throw a baseball, because what if they're really badly blind? But you throw a Nerf ball at them, and they put their hand out and catch it. Amazing. It's amazing how the visual, I mean, I like to think of the visual stuff, because, of course, it's something we can all talk about. I mean, I can't talk about how I think. And you don't want to know how I think. But we can't talk about that. But we can talk about vision. And I can tell you that color and shape and motion and color in motion and shape in motion are all detected and analyzed using different parts of your occipital lobe. So you don't just, this whole notion of five senses, vision has like five senses of its own. Right? So it's really quite amazing. And it happens seamlessly, doesn't it? Isn't it amazing that it happens seamlessly? It really is, isn't it? Because I don't notice. When something starts to move, it's not like I notice the other system kicking in. There isn't like a little blip and something else happens. It just happens. The other neat thing, too, about the, say someone gets a lesion and they don't see motion anymore, it's only motion of objects, not the movement of the image on their retina. So if they move their head, the images are still there. But if something else moves, that's when it disappears. So there's all this feedback going on. It's incredibly complicated how it works. And it's really, I mean, amazing. It's amazing.
Dave,
yeah?
When a certain part of your brain gets excited, or
yes.
Not excited, but triggered.
Sure, yeah.
Does it like vaguely move a little
bit? Does it move? Probably on some very tiny, 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 tiny level. Never thought about that before. Yeah, probably, but it wouldn't be detectable. Yeah, it wouldn't be detectable, but I mean, the way you would detect it is you'd see glucose uptake. So there would be movement, but it would be so small. It wouldn't be like, it's like a muscle in that sense. That's a neat question. Never thought about that before. There must be some, I would imagine. But it's probably virtually impossible to detect, I would think. Yeah, that's neat. Never thought of that. Other questions? Yeah, people also call it visual cortex, yeah. Yep. One of the problems with the gross anatomy stuff is that sometimes there are different names for the same region. Occipital lobe is also called visual cortex, but then you've got, there are different brain maps. Now, when we talk about occipital lobe, it has five layers, V1, V2, V3, V4, V5. But we also have, there's another kind of map called the Brodmann map, and it's areas 17, 18, and 19. And that thing is totally named randomly. It's not like he started at the front and went back. It's like he was like, oh, I haven't done that part yet. So like 17, 18, and 19 right beside each other, like 20 somewhere else. I'll typically call it occipital lobe. When we talk about vision, I'll call it visual cortex probably, because we talk about V1 to V5. The Brodmann areas aren't nearly as, they're more about, oh, that looks like an area to me. They're a lot more like that. And again, these divisions are somewhat arbitrary. They're somewhat arbitrary. Unlike, say, cerebellum, you can see it's a separate thing. Brainstem is a separate thing. And of course, as we know, it's holding the brain up. Looks like the color there, it looks like it might actually be celery. It's your brain celery. All right. Now the cortex, it's the wrinkly bits on top. Then there's subcortical structures. We're just talking about the different cortical areas, right? So that's the different lobes of the cortex, or we also hear it called neocortex, right? Now there's subcortical. Underneath it, there's stuff. So there's subcortical structures. Oh, here we go. Look, this poor guy had his brain cut open. It's just a diagram. It's not a real person. So you can see here, we've now sort of gone into the cortex. Hippocampus. Zoop. See, shaped like a seahorse if you've been looking at seahorses all day. It's sort of curly. You could also, they could have called it maybe the Greek name for cinnamon bun. I think that would have been better. So that's hippocampus, and it does a lot of stuff to do with memory. This is actually lifted out of the book. There's the amygdala. There it is. And you see, it's got an almond kind of shape to it, and it's not, the size would be like a big almond. It's got to do with emotion, especially intense emotion, anger, fear. It also seems to have something to do with memory. It's right near hippocampus. And emotional memories, things that have strong emotion tied to them, are remembered better. And it seems like there's a connection that's made there when a strong emotional memory is made. There's the thalamus, and I don't know, yeah, there it is. The thalamus is like a sensory switchboard, okay? Almost all sensory information, no matter what it is, goes through the thalamus. The only thing it doesn't is smell. Smell goes straight back to the amygdala and the hippocampus. It's the only sensory system we have that does not go through the thalamus. Everything else goes through the thalamus. And when I was talking about that work I did, disrupting the foraging in these rats, they had to recognize the size of pieces of food, and they would behave differently depending upon the size of the piece of food. So we went after thalamus because, thinking it well, it's like a sensory switchboard. They're detecting things about their environment there. The hypothalamus, which is not on here, it would be down here-ish. Hypothalamus, a lot of thermoregulation, a lot of homeostatic stuff, keeping your body the right temperature, starting you from eating, stopping you from eating, starting you from drinking, stopping you from drinking, things like that. Monitoring your blood chemistry, you know, it's just all kinds of stuff like that. The nucleus accumbens, which also is not here, which would be right about there. The accumbens is part of the reward circuit. Okay, so when the accumbens is activated, it feels good. Things feel good. The accumbens has receptors in it for things like opiates. So, for example, there are receptors for things like heroin, basically. But also, of course, as you probably know, we make our own heroin, right? There are receptors there for cannabinoids, marijuana. There are receptors there. There's all kinds of different receptors there. But also, it's activated whenever anything feels good. And that can be any kind of feel good. So it's the reward system. Because and that kind of feel good includes everything from watching Family Guy to having an orgasm, which is sort of running the gamut somehow, it seems to me. So anything that feels good, it's operated.
Where is it found?
It is in the, it's down about here. It's in the middle of the limbic system. This is basically here called the limbic system. Okay, so it's going to be down below the hippocampus.
So is it part of the
forebrain
then?
No, it's part of the limbic system. So it's not part of the forebrain now. A little deeper down.
Part of the limbic system.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. There's the medulla that has to do with sleep and wakefulness. Whoops. Sleep and wakefulness. Wakes you up, puts you to sleep. Along with some other structures that take care of that as well. You can see a lot of these very basic functions. Emotion. Homeostatic functions. Things feeling good. Stuff like that. Okay, so these are not, there's not a whole lot of thinking going on here. It's more like reaction to stimuli. And everything has these things. We have more cortex than any other animal on the planet. Right? We have a lot more cortex than any other animal on the planet. All right. Any questions about that? Sort of hitting the high notes here. Now, the brain, not only is it divided into your various lobes, it's also divided into two hemispheres. And those hemispheres are connected via the corpus callosum. That is Latin for big body. No, it really is. I took Latin for 4 years. I know some of these things. I forget a lot of the Latin I learned, but I did take Latin for high school. It's somewhat useful. On the off chance you teach neuroanatomy someday, it's great to know some Latin. So the corpus callosum is this big bundle of fibers between the two hemispheres. By the way, not all animals have a corpus callosum. Not everybody has a corpus callosum. See, this is, it's a really big body of fibers, and women typically have a bigger corpus callosum than men do. I was talking before about the efficiencies in that, so and that's probably what leads to that. Now, a lot of birds only have a small bundle of fibers right at the back that connect the two hemispheres. In essence, birds, in a lot of respects, a lot of birds, are split brain patients. They have two brains. The nice thing this allows you to do is you can, if one eye, if the left eye is wired to the right half of the brain, and the right eye is wired to the left half of the brain, you can then teach half the brain something and see if the other part of the brain remembers it. And this is what Nikki Clayton has done with food-storing birds. She takes them and takes these little caps and takes glue, but it's sort of not permanent glue. It's like the kind of glue people use to put on false eyelashes. And she puts it on the bird's eye. And now the bird only knows what goes into it, say, its right eye. So its left brain knows where it put food. Its right brain doesn't. So now the bird goes and flies around. So it stores a seed with its left eye covered, so the right eye is open. And then it flies back in with the other eye covered. Can't find the seed. Except if you wait about 24 hours, eventually the information travels to the other part of the brain. And then it does know where to put it. Pretty cool. The way that it was originally shown that it was that food storing birds were using memory to recover their own seeds, the best piece of evidence that came out way early on, maybe 25 years ago, stuff Dave Sherry did, where he had chickadees storing food with one of their eyes covered and then trying to recover it with the other eye. And they couldn't. I was like, well, they must be using memory, because if they were using smell or some sort of rule, it shouldn't matter which eye they're using. So, pretty cool stuff. Questions so far? Okay, in the brain, they got neurons and glial cells. Now, there are many subtypes of neurons, and there are many subtypes of glial cells, and you will learn them all. But right now, let's know that neurons do communication and glial cells do support. Support functions. They do things like they repair stuff, they take out stuff that shouldn't be there, they fix dead tissue, remove dead tissue, they make the myelin sheath, they do all kinds of stuff like that. They sort of hold it together. Glia is a Latin word meaning glue. Now, neurons, of course, have axons and dendrites. The axon is basically what sends information out to the next neuron. The dendrite receives information. A whole bunch of neurons connected together is called either a tract or a nerve, depending on where it is. Typically, though not always, it's called a nerve if it's in the nervous system and a tract if it's in the central nervous system, and a tract if it's in the peripheral nervous system, but it isn't always the case. Right, so that bundle of fibers down here, isn't that your ulnar nerve, is that what it's called? The funny bone? I can't remember. That's a whole bunch of neurons. A big bundle of them. And it feels like it's about, half-inch coax. Whoops. No, that's no big deal. But I'll go back anyway. All right. So now we've gone from the big brain bits down to the smaller cell bits. Tired. No, I am. My little boy's sick and he's got a sore throat and I was up a lot of the night. Yeah, well, I'm going home after this. He'll live. Poor guy, though.
That means you're going to get sick.
Yeah, but I'll keep coming to work and stuff. Yeah. All right, CNS, PNS, the central nervous system, peripheral nervous system. The division of the nervous system into the CNS and the PNS is really about anatomy. Okay, and that's a lot of what we're talking about today, as I said at the beginning, is anatomy, where stuff is. The central nervous system, the peripheral nervous system. The central nervous system is in the brain and the spinal column and the cerebellum, the peripherals everywhere else. Though we can make some other distinctions, like typically damage in the central nervous system is not repaired. It can't really be repaired. You lose a neuron in the CNS, it's gone. The PNS is different. You're losing neurons in the peripheral nervous system. You can fix those. The distinction, though, between CNS and PNS is really not so much about physiology as it is about anatomy. So if you want to look at it physiologically, there is another sort of system of naming you can use. And again, this is why this stuff gets kind of confusing, because, there's these different bits that, in one set of classifications has this name, and another set of classifications has that name. It's kind of annoying. Physiologically, we often talk about the cranial nervous system, which means it's in your cranium, it's in your head, right? And the spinal nervous system, that's the rest, the stuff that's all controlled by your spine. Old column, not your spine. It's not actually your spine that does the controlling. Either is fine. Okay, so you might hear me use both. I'll tend to talk about CNS, PNS because I'm just more used to that. But there's nothing wrong with going the other way either. The book basically goes back and forth too, though I think the book's more into the sort of cranial spinal thing. Any questions at this point? Still doing well?
Excellent.
Yeah.
They know why the central nerves don't.
Oh, why the CNS doesn't fix itself? Yeah. There's actually what happens when something in the PNS or in a developing CNS, when there's damage, it gets repaired really pretty easily, and it involves something called neurogrowth factor, which is just a chemical that's released. In the CNS, neurogrowth factor is inhibited. Now you might think, well, then why don't we just make it available? In fact, that kind of idea has been tried. The part of the difficulty is partly it's the wiring, just having to rewire rewiring a brain wouldn't be easy, but not nearly probably as complicated as you might think. The thing is, when you block the substance that blocks neural growth factor, it does other things. We will talk about that. It's amazing how the repair happens, because what happens is these glial cells come along. They move the dead tissue out. They actually make, in essence, they make a tunnel from where the damage starts to where it ends. And then neural growth factor is released basically along this tunnel, and a new piece of cable's laid. It's really quite amazing. The thing is, brain is one thing, right? We may never be able to fix someone's brain, hook it back up, but a spinal column. And this is where there's a lot of hope for these kind of, for people that get these, quadriplegic, paraplegic type people. The connections in there, while they're complicated and there's millions of neurons, it's not like trying to rewire someone's memories. That's never, well, I shouldn't say never, because somebody will come up with a paper next week doing it. But that's probably not going to happen anytime soon anyway. Whereas this, it's like, oh yeah, that's the connection from that part of your brain runs down through your spinal column out to your left leg to that. Well, that's pretty easy. Everybody's works like that. So I think there's a lot of hope there. And the problem is also that the glial cells won't go in and do the cleaning out, and they also don't go in and you get scarring as well. And the glial cells then don't release the neural growth factor. What's been tried, actually, is putting little microtubes in. So you go in, you do an operation, you cut someone's spinal column open, and you put these little tiny tubes in from where the damage started and where it ended. And this has actually been somewhat successful with rats. You put this little tube in, and then you release neural growth factor, and actually you get the connections made again. It will happen. Quadriplegics, paraplegics will walk in our lifetime.
So with CNS, there's just constant degradation that will never
be. Oh yeah, I mean your CNS, there's neurons dying right now in all of us. You're born with all the neurons in your CNS you're ever going to have. You have a baby has more neurons than you do. They just aren't connected up. Right? Yeah.
Is that what they're doing in Portugal with those back surgeries?
I don't know. Really? It may be. I haven't heard about this.
Some movement back, but not walking.
That's amazing. I mean, like I said, it will happen. See if we find out something about that, though, because it sounds interesting. But yeah, in our lifetime, I would venture a guess within 10 years, they'll be very tricky off your operations. They won't always work, but people will walk again, which is just incredible. Yeah?
Other than getting in an accident, how would one lose a neuron?
Let's see. One just died now. There's another one. Just cell death, yeah. When cells aren't synapsing, when they aren't connecting, neurons have in them programmed cell death. They die. They're programmed to die. When NGF is released, neural growth factor, and some other growth factors, and we'll get there. But when it synapses, a chemical signal sent out saying, "Don't die. We're using you," basically. And you think about, well, why would there be programmed cell death? Remember we said before about how much of your resources are being used by neurons? If a neuron isn't being used, why keep it up? So they just die. So this is why with a baby has way, way, way more neurons than anybody in this room, but there's no connections being made yet. They haven't been made yet. So there's just sort of, this is a vast oversimplification, but there's like free-floating neurons floating around waiting to hook up. When they don't hook up with each other, they literally die. It's programmed cell death. This happens, we know, I talked about Nikki Clayton's work with the food stores. We know this happens with food storing marsh tits. If they don't store food before day 44 post-hatch, their hippocampus shrinks because it doesn't get used. The brain, the nervous system, the cells, the neurons in the nervous system, in the CNS, are working under a use it or lose it proposition. If they don't get used, they die. And that is horribly sensible because they're really expensive things to maintain. These aren't like epithelial cells, you know, they make extra ones, yeah.
So say you could be injected with more glia cells, would that help your neuron production?
The thing is, the way the stem cells work, neural stem cells in an adult, they may make a new cell, but then they die, so they don't do any replacing. That's why we have to get fetal stem cells to do this kind of work.
Okay.
Right? And then George Bush gets mad at you. And you know what happens then? Invasion. Little joke. Yeah? Oh, geez, I don't know. That's an excellent question. You are born with way more than you'll ever need. Way more than you'll ever need. The interesting thing is when people say, like, they go out drinking and they say they're going to kill some brain cells, actually, mostly they're killing glial cells. But when there's glial cells dying and you don't have enough glial cells, and glial cells can be remade, but when glial cells die, they can't support neurons, and then the neurons they're supposed to be supporting die.
You said the glial cells can?
Oh, they can, yeah. Yeah, that's different. Yep. But neurons, they're a once-in-a-lifetime proposition. You're born with, well, you're not, you're, as you develop, and we'll talk all about development, but as your nervous system develops, they do multiply. And fetal neural stem cells actually do end up making more than one daughter cell. They make two daughter cells. What happens with stem cells in an adult is you get a daughter cell, but one of them dies, so it doesn't do any replacing. It's really bizarre. I've been wrestling with this from an evolutionary perspective. Why is it that you can't, like, say you get a spinal injury, why is that mechanism there? And I don't know. I'm sure someone else does know and has looked into this. I just haven't really read a whole lot about it. I've been just sort of doing thought experiments about it, and I can't figure it out. Other questions? These are good questions. This is fun. It's much more fun than actually. Fun for making me have to think rather than just sitting out here spouting off stuff I've said before. All right. So some cranial stuff then. Cranial nerves, 12 sets of two. I mentioned this before. You don't want to lose these. These are important. They basically control, it's I/O control from the head. That's why it's called the cranial nervous system. Now, the brainstem gets inputs from the various senses, okay? Through these cranial nerves. And sends outputs to the rest of the body. And not the head, though. There are cranial nerves that are running your face. Weird way to put it, isn't it? They run your face. You know, like for talking and such. That's sent out, though, to the spinal system. Everything sensory, when I say sensory, what I'm talking about here is especially things like touch, okay? You have information coming in, and it goes through, let's say at the end of my index finger on my right hand here, all the way through, down through my, well, where would that be roughly? Right about there, probably, through my spinal column up to my brain, and then to control it, just the other side of my spinal column comes out and controls that part of my finger. The cranial nervous system is sometimes divided into what's called the hindbrain, the midbrain, and the diencephalon. One of the great ways, by the way, to remember all this stuff, well, some of it anyway, do you remember the cartoon Pinky and the Brain? Yeah. There was a wonderful little 30-second sketch where the two of them teach you neuroanatomy. And they actually get stuff right, which is really quite amazing. And it's sung to the tune of Camp Ten Lee, sing this song, do-da, do-da, you know? But it goes, and Pinky keeps saying, brainstem, brainstem. It's awesome. So you can search that out on legal places to download things on the internet. BitTorrent. So we're going to divide hindbrain, midbrain, diencephalon. Let's talk about the hindbrain. You're going to guess that this is at the hind part of the brain. You'd be right. A lot of fine movements going on here. Balance. So we're talking really a lot about sort of back here in cerebellum. You ask what cerebellum does? It's like fine motor stuff, balance. My little routine with the umbrella before probably had something to do with what I fell. It wasn't working very well. Right, here we are. It may be important in learning the cerebellum because it probably has something to do with time. And knowing when stuff happens is really important when you're learning something, because learning's all about predicting the future from the past, right? It also deals with really quick movements. So if you look at something that does hunting by, like, with its tongue, you know, like the frogs that stick their tongue out and grab the fly, they got a big-ass cerebellum. That's pretty quick movement. We invested our effort into having a giant brain, so we don't have to do that. We can enslave frogs and have them catch flies for our pleasure. I don't even know what that meant. I talked about before the medulla, so here, it's in here, the reticular formation. This does sleep and wakefulness, basically, usually using hormones like melatonin, which is at that point also a neurotransmitter. There are people out there probably who have taken melatonin to sleep. I think I took a melatonin to go to sleep last night, actually. No, it's a totally safe and wonderful thing. And then when your kid's sick and you wake up at 3 o'clock and you got that, my God, I must sleep deeply. Melatonin is telling me to sleep. And he's looking at you going, throat hurts. Sleep and wakefulness. There's a lot of connections to the cortex to wake you up. See, you're not supposed to be awakened by an alarm clock. That means you didn't get enough sleep. Right? The way you're supposed to be awakened is by your reticular formation going, Dave. And if your name's Dave. It's kind of creepy if your name's not Dave and it's calling you Dave, and at that point, you know, that's when the best solution that you put on a tinfoil hat so the aliens can't control your thoughts. But so it sends basically messages to your cortex saying, you know, wake up, wake up, wake up, because that's and I hate the word conscious, but I mean the cortex, a lot of what it's doing, especially up here in the frontal lobe, is this sort of conscious processing. So if it's sending information there, it's like, just come on, wake up. You know, that's like sometimes now and then, every 8 months or a year, especially if you have children, once every couple of years, you actually, perhaps they're off somewhere else, and you wake up in the morning, and you just wanted to wake up. I've heard about that. It's been a long time. I remember, I think that would have been in high school during the summer is the last time I probably woke up like that. No, I guess when I was an undergraduate, it was Fridays. I didn't have a class till 2:30. So sleep till like noon. It's awesome. So that's what those connections do, and that's a lot of the hindbrain. And actually, speaking of my child not feeling well and me wanting to go to sleep but having to go home and take care of him, but I love him, so it's not like it's a chore. We'll continue this next time. Thanks, everybody. We'll be right back.
sure you don't always approve of the choices I make. At least I'm not afraid to stand up for the chances I take. For every breath spring that I've reached for, I missed a thousand times before. What else is living for?
Copyright Sharealike 2.0 Canada 2006. Some rights reserved. You are free to redistribute the information as long as you give attribution and do not use it for commercial purposes. The feed is feeds.feedburner.com /Dave_6. Email can be sent to Broadbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. All programs are recorded using a Griffin iTalk 2, a lapel microphone, and my iPod. They are then transposed onto my Intel-based MacBook Pro and mixed with GarageBand. For information on the music featured at the beginning and end of each episode, check the iTunes show notes or fire me off an email. Most of the stuff comes from a website called GarageBand. Thank you, everybody, and see you next time.